Hey everybody, Jace here. I wanted to talk about something before we get to the episode. Just in these crazy times of the coronavirus and social distancing and people needing to self-quarantine, obviously we know comic shops could be hurting in the near term without that cash flow. So be sure and pick up your pull box. Be sure and set up delivery or curbside pickup or whatever you need to do. Be sure you try to keep that cash flow going for them. Understand not everybody's going to be able to. Some people themselves, especially in the hospitality industry, aren't getting paid right now, and things are uncertain, and people are stressed out, and I get it. But if you're able to help, if you're able to make sure you keep in contact with your comic book store, that's definitely a plus. And there's another business that's being impacted by the cancellation of Comic-Cons and such that I wanted to talk about, and it's Hero Within. I'm a big fan of Hero Within. We've had Tony B. Kim, the founder of Hero Within, on the show before to talk about it. And what they do is they make geek apparel, I guess you'd say, that's really more of a higher end product than just a t-shirt. That's not to say that they don't make t-shirts, but you know, something you can wear that's nicer. Like I have the Superman blazer that's absolutely amazing. It has tons of pockets. On the back, stitched in is the outline of the Superman emblem. They do another one for Batman. They just have some really, really high quality apparel that allows you to kind of let your geek flag fly without being in your face. You know, things you could wear to the office or out to a nice dinner. They're doing pre-orders now for a couple of things. And I encourage you all to go to their website and check it out. And if you're able to pick something up, not only because it's super cool, but because you'd really be helping out Hero Within, Tony Kim, and the whole Hero Within family. With all these conventions closed and canceled and postponed, it's really hurting them because that's where they do the majority of their business, and they could really use your support right now. So follow Hero Within on social media to find out about special deals they have going on right now. I'll put links in the show notes to all of the stuff. Twitter is at Hero Within INC, so at Hero Within Inc. Tony himself has a Twitter, and he's really funny, and he's such a great guy. He really is one of us. He hosts panels at comic conventions, and he loves talking about Marvel movies and these heroes and everything. So give him a follow as well. It's at Crazy4ComicCon. That's the number 4. You can also find Hero Within on Instagram. Just do a search for Hero Within. And then, of course, their website, which is HeroWithinStore.com. And again, I think it's really worthwhile. I love what Tony does. And you can tell how much he cares and how much he is one of us. Even based on the fact that right now in these tough times, what Tony decided to do is to create a Stand Together shirt with these people having to be self-quarantined and everybody's supposed to keep their distance from everybody. It's sort of feels like we're more divided than ever, right? Like the world is divisive enough. So this is something you can do. You can go and buy the Stand Together t-shirt. You can wear it and you can feel like you're part of something that we're all coming together, despite the fact that we're all being told we need to stay apart. And on top of that message that this shirt is sending, Tony and Hero Within are also going to be donating a portion of the proceeds for all the sales from the Stand Together t-shirts to the COVID-19 Solidarity Response Fund for the World Health Organization. So again, it just shows what a great guy Tony is, how socially conscious he is, how much he cares. So again, this is not a paid advertisement. Tony didn't ask me to do this. I just feel like what Tony and his team do is so great. If you ever have been at a convention, if you go by the Hero Within booth, it's such a great community. You have people that have bought clothing in the past that just come by and just want to say hi to Tony and his staff. You have people coming to pick up the, you know, whatever the new latest apparel is, whether it be DC or Marvel or the Star Trek license that they have now. It's just a great, fun time, and it brings people together. And so, again, I love Tony. I'm proud to consider him a friend, and I just love that what he does helps bring us together. And it was no surprise to me when I found out about the Stand Together t-shirt and Tony donating a portion of the proceeds to the World Health Organization. It's just the kind of guy he is. So I thought, well, for the foreseeable future, I'm going to throw this bumper in front of the podcast to make sure to give a signal boost. And those that can help, please do so. And even if you can't, you can shout out Hero Within on social media and help spread the word. And we can be sure that Hero Within can weather this storm. So thanks for listening, as always, everybody. And I hope you enjoyed the episode.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. And this is an X-Men Tuesday episode, and today we're going to be talking about Uncanny X-Men Annual Number 1. This is the annual where Cyclops got resurrected, so I wouldn't go so far as to call this a Cyclops spotlight episode, but we're going to be talking a lot about who Cyclops is as a character, who he was before he died. Maybe why they decided to bring him back when they did. Kind of a brief history of Cyclops. Like I said, I wouldn't go so far as to call it a spotlight just because we're not going to get into a lot of the early days. This is more of a look at the modern Cyclops, kind of how we feel as a character, maybe why Marvel decided to bring him back when they did. I'm joined by John Paul, who is a big X-Men fan. So thanks for taking the time to join me, John Paul.
No problem.
Before we get into the annual itself, let's talk a little bit about kind of our feelings about Cyclops. Like, I'm not even sure that I know what era of X-Men, what version of Cyclops, if you will, was the first one you were exposed to, and what your feelings on him as a character were or are.
Well, the very first time I was exposed to him was from X-Men the Animated Series back in 92. That's actually a lot of where my introduction to the comic books in general was X-Men the Animated Series. And initially I thought he had a very cool look. You know, he had the Jim Lee Blue Team version look in the cartoon. He wasn't my favorite character, but he wasn't like my least favorite character either. I just thought he had a cool look with the costume and also the visor. So that's my introduction to him. And I didn't really start reading any of his comics until later in life. But I think he gets a unfair shake from a lot of people who think he's boring, or even when he turned more recently in the 2010s, becoming almost a villain. I still think he's an interesting character.
Yeah, interesting. I don't know that I'd use that. I will say that he has an interesting backstory. There's interesting aspects to his character. But I am one of those people that found his personality to be a little, I won't say boring, but kind of rigid. He never really seemed like, he always seemed uptight to me, right? Like, I can understand where the boring stuff comes from, why people would think that. Because he was always sort of the consummate student, right? Like the kid that you knew in high school who, you know, was almost a teacher's pet, but not really, because he didn't really suck up. But he, you know, he always did the right thing. He always got good grades. He always towed the line, you know, just kind of a real button down, straight lace kind of guy, never got in trouble, you know, never questioned authority, just did what they were told, you know, and I can see why some people would consider that boring. Like, well, this guy never takes a chance. He never questions anything that he's told by, you know, authority figures, and he just kind of toes the line. And that's kind of who Cyclops always was, right? Like, he was the first student recruited by Xavier to the school, and he was the leader of the X-Men. And if he ever showed any emotion, it was usually annoyance at Wolverine for not, you know, listening or not, you know, following the rules, doing things a different way. And that was kind of the only emotion that Scott ever really showed was anger. And I almost feel like the whole reason they created the Jean and Scott love story was to kind of humanize Cyclops in a way, to bring, you know, more facets to his character, because he did seem so one-dimensional. So he definitely wasn't my favorite when I started reading the classic X-Men stuff. My first exposure to X-Men was the Claremont, Dave Cockrum and John Byrne, kind of the classic X-Men era, if you will. I think I started right around the issue 172 when Rogue joins X-Men, and then I went back and read from Giant Size 1 up. But yeah, Cyclops was fine. He was the leader. I didn't actively dislike him, but he certainly wasn't my favorite, and I kind of found him to be, I don't know, just kind of one-dimensional as a character. Like, I felt like there were a lot of interesting aspects of his character that you would think would come out in his personality. That, you know, the fact that he was orphaned at a young age, he had this brother Havoc, you know, his relationship with Jean, that sort of thing. But he could never unwind, you know, he never seemed to be able to kick back. And that, I guess, it made him a little inaccessible to me as a reader. And so I just kind of felt like, it's Cyclops, whatever, I could take him or leave him. But I was very surprised when he left the X-Men for a while. That surprised me, and then
like to form his own group.
Well, he left originally after Jean died. He just needed a break, and then he ended up marrying Madeline Pryor, who was a clone of Jean created by Mr. Sinister. I mean, this X-Men history gets really convoluted, and then
X-Men is convoluted.
Yeah, and then he really didn't come back until X-Factor. When mm-hmm. you know, the original Jean Grey, it was discovered that she didn't die, and then so they got the original five back together in X-Factor, but they were posing as government mutant hunters, which always didn't sit quite right with me. They were actually stoking the fears of mutants, but I get kind of why they did it, kind of a Thunderbolt sort of thing in a way. But that was a more interesting Cyclops, because then he was conflicted. You know, here he left his wife and child. Madeline Pryor, who he had married, to come back to Jean, because Jean was resurrected, and he had conflicted feelings, and so that made him a little more interesting. And then eventually, there was a big shakeup in the early 90s, and all the books got rearranged. X-Factor became something totally different, and Cyclops was back in the regular X-Men. That's kind of where he stayed for a lot of years, and then it wasn't until the Avengers versus X-Men event was where he really started changing. And that was what? Was that 2012-ish? Avengers versus X-Men? And, you know,
I'd have to look.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure it was 2012. And so between that time, between the 90s and 2012, that 20-year history, you can kind of think of that as, I won't say a golden age of X-Men, because I really think that was, you know, the 80s. As far as good, solid storytelling. But I will say this about that era from the 90s when comics went through that crash. But then coming out of that, you had some really great storytelling. You had new X-Men from Grant Morrison, John Cassidy art, and all that kind of stuff. But the other thing that happened during that time, and this even started probably, you know, early 90s and went through even modern day, really, it became the era of events, you know, one event after another. And the X-Men were no stranger to that. You know, we had all kinds of events, you know, the mutant massacre, just tons of them. It was one after another, you know, House of M and Age of Apocalypse, and some of them were good, some of them, you know, not so great. Extinction Agenda was another early one. And so there certainly was a lot of shakeup in the world of the X-Men, a lot of turmoil, if you will. You know, the X-Men have always been, you know, more on the fringes. Going back to the earliest days, people think of them as an analog to the civil rights movement and mutants and, you know, Magneto fighting for mutant rights and such. And really, it was with House of M that this all sort of came to a head, with Scarlet Witch whispering, "No more mutants," which I still, like, I get why they did it. Quesada said, yeah, there's just too many mutants and too many X-Men, and it had gotten too convoluted, and we need to kind of wipe the slate clean and dial it back. And so, you know, Scarlet Witch whispers, "No more mutants," and you go down to 198 mutants. And then that really bothered Scott, maybe more so than anybody. probably for the aspect of his personality that he was always, he always saw himself as the leader. He always saw himself as the protector, and really kind of the first flag bearer or standard bearer of Charles Xavier's dream of mutants and humans living together in peace and harmony, rather than Magneto's view that that could never happen. And the only way mutants are going to be allowed to live and survive and prosper is if they are kind of above humans, right? Like you have Homo sapiens, humans, and you have Homo superior, where superior is better. So in order for us to survive, we should be the ruling class, if you will. And Cyclops never really bought into that. But then he sees through the events of House of M how there are all these mutants that are have their powers removed just because Scarlet Witch decides that that's what should happen. And that really kind of left him a changed man. It really started planting the seeds, if you will, for what happened in Avengers versus X-Men. Now, did you read Avengers versus X-Men, John Paul? Were you 2012? Were you reading?
I'm currently reading it. I've gone through an overview of it, and from what I've seen, I kind of jumped straight to the ending.
Yeah,
and the ending was kind of anticlimactic.
The ending is not.
You couldn't do more with it.
Yeah, yeah. The ending of that story of it, it was such a great event leading up to, and the ending, it just sort of ends, just like. And then they kind of explain a little bit, but yeah, the ending was weak for what it actually was, because it really like took over Avengers versus X-Men took over the whole Marvel universe. For the duration of it. And so it was kind of interesting, but if you read it, you do kind of get the idea of, I mean, it's a couple different things. It plays off a couple different, big ideas in the Marvel universe here. So again, we had House of M in 2005, and it, from then, you know, the 5 to 7 years before Avengers versus X-Men, you really see that Cyclops is doing his best to try to continue to protect mutants and uphold that dream of Xavier. But it's almost like he starts to realize that maybe it's not possible. He kind of gets discouraged, you know, it's not, things are not going the way he wants them to go, but he's certainly not to the point where he wants to swing over to Magneto's way of thinking until you get to Avengers versus X-Men. And we're not, this is again, a huge event, a lot of moving parts. So I'll just give you kind of the broad strokes as it applies to Cyclops. And basically what happens is the Avengers find out that the Phoenix Force is on its way back to Earth. The Phoenix Force believes that Hope Summers is going to be its new vessel. Remember, Jean Summers is dead at this time. And so the Avengers set out to stop this from happening. They don't want this to happen. And Cyclops, along with the rest of the X-Men, believe that the Avengers are kind of meddling in affairs that aren't really their purview. You know, it's not really their business.
Right, mutant business.
Yeah, it's mutant business. And Cyclops especially, this is kind of the culmination of that frustration he's felt ever since the end of House of M. You know, why can't mutants just be left to live in peace? Why does everybody keep telling us, you know, how to live? Like, don't we deserve the same rights as everybody else, free will and self-determination and all that? And this is mutant business and they shouldn't be meddling with it. But they also remember that Cyclops, more than anybody, remembers what happened to who he believed was Jean Grey at the time, who became corrupted by the Phoenix Force and eventually became Dark Phoenix. You know, we found out later on that it was a kind of a clone of Jean that the Phoenix Force had actually created that became corrupted. But at the time that it happened, Scott believed that, you know, this power had corrupted his beloved, you know, the woman that he loved. And so they're, the X-Men, more than anybody, are fully aware of the consequences of what happens when someone isn't prepared. And in a way, they know that nobody can ever be prepared to really be a host for the full power of the Phoenix Force, right? Now, the Phoenix Force is a multiversal power. It doesn't just exist in the Marvel 616 universe. There's one Phoenix Force that exists across the entirety of the Marvel multiverse. So, you know, the Ultimate Earth 616, all the rest of them, it exists. It's just one Phoenix Force that exists across all. There's not multiple versions of it. So that gives you an idea of just how powerful it is. And so, you know, that old saying, power corrupts, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. And the Phoenix Force isn't really meant to be held by one person. It's, you know, godlike power, the ability to manipulate reality and such. And it's just hard for somebody human. And if you are human, by definition, you're imperfect. It's hard for an imperfect being to contain that much power and not kind of go power mad, which is, you know, what happened to the original clone of Jean. And that's the woman that Scott saw, you know, die before his eyes and believed that he'd lost the love of his life. So the X-Men aren't saying in Avengers versus X-Men that the Avengers are wrong to be concerned, but what they're saying is, this is mutant business, let us handle it. So Cyclops himself doesn't believe that Hope Summers is ready to contain this full Phoenix Force either. And so they believe they need to train her. So through some various events in Avengers versus X-Men, the Phoenix Force gets split into five different X-Men, the Phoenix Five, as they're referred to. So you had Cyclops, you had Colossus, you had Magic, Colossus' sister, you had Namor, and you had Emma Frost. So those five.
I always thought that Namor was interesting.
Yeah, you don't necessarily think of Namor as a mutant, but then when you look at the other Atlanteans, you realize, yeah, he's got white skin instead of blue skin, right. And he's got, you know, different powers of him. You don't really think of him as a mutant, but really he's Marvel's first mutant in terms of publishing. You know, he was right. The first one to actually be published, as opposed to Apocalypse, which supposedly is the first mutant in actual historical times. So anyway, you have this Phoenix Five, and you see sort of the same thing start playing out. Even though each of the Phoenix Five has only one-fifth of the Phoenix Force, it's still too much power for these, even though they're not human, they're more than human, they're homo superior, but it's still too much for these mortal beings to handle, to control, and it certainly affects Cyclops maybe more than anybody. In terms of changing who he is as a person, I mean, you kind of see Namor's still Namor, always spoiling for a fight. Right. Colossus, yep. Always one of the more noble X-Men. He seems to be the one least affected by it, perhaps. A little bit when he gets in a fight with his sister, but he maintains a pretty even keel. I mean, he's a pretty even-keeled kind of guy. His sister Magic less so. It seems to affect her a little more. She goes a little more power hungry than her brother. And I, when I was reading it, I remember kind of attributing that to the fact that she was raised in Limbo, and maybe, you know, by Belasco, kind of this demonic entity, and maybe some of that. We know she has the Dark Child persona that is inside her. So maybe some of that residual tendency toward doing no good, doing evil, kind of had her a little further on the spectrum than her brother. Emma Frost has always been a manipulative B word. She used to be a straight up villain, you know, the White Queen of the Hellfire Club, an enemy of the X-Men. So you can see her, you know, doing her usual stuff. Yeah, her machinations, exactly. And so it didn't really seem that it changed her personality much. Maybe just gave her more of the ability to do things a little more overtly, because she was always more of the person pulling the puppet strings behind the scenes. And now with the Phoenix Force, she's got a little bit of the power to do that more out in the open. But I think Cyclops is the one that got changed the most. And again, I think a lot of... Go ahead.
That's up for debate, I think. I think it just brought out his darkest desires.
Well, see, that's what I was going to say. You wonder if him having the Phoenix Force, him finally having the power to do something about these frustrations that he's felt ever since the House of M happened, and mutants were mistreated in maybe the worst way ever in his mind. And he's lived with that for all this time, you know, 7 years in publishing history, obviously, you know, a shorter period of time in actual comic book history, but he's been living with that. It's always been in the back of his mind. He's been frustrated by it. And now all of a sudden he has this part of the Phoenix Force.
and he is he's finally got the ability to do something. But I get what you're saying. Maybe this was just always what he kind of had in the back of his mind. But I still, the thing is, the change, and you can point to this as something that you like or is well done, or something that you can point to about it being basically handled sloppily by Marvel. Because if you go back and you look at Cyclops at the beginning, or even in the 90s, certainly in the Claremont Byrne run of the early 80s, but even going as far as the 90s, Cyclops is a hero. He's a noble guy. He's going to do the right thing. You know, I was talking about that earlier, always doing the right thing to the point of being annoying. We look at that versus the Cyclops that we see at the in the Uncanny X-Men 2013 series from Brian Michael Bendis, or even at the beginning of the Death of X event, which we're going to talk about in a little bit. Like, you look at that Cyclops versus the Cyclops I was just talking about that always did the right thing. That is such a stark contrast. It doesn't even feel like the same character. But it does happen gradually over time. But this event, this Avengers versus X-Men event, is really the event where you kind of reach the climax of that change in the character, which is why some people hate it. Like, people who loved Cyclops hate this event, because in their mind, Cyclops is acting wildly out of character. Whereas others say, well, you finally made Cyclops interesting by making him conflicted. So I can kind of see it both ways.
Yeah,
but they same do. Here. But they do give an out for the people who are fans of Cyclops, right? And they say, "Well, yeah, he's acting out of character, and he's doing these things that are more Magneto-like, for a lack of a better term. But he's doing it because he's quote unquote possessed by the Phoenix Force." So you have an out if you're a Cyclops fan to say, "Well, yeah, he did this kind of stuff, but he wouldn't have done it if he hadn't been possessed by the Phoenix Force." So again, I can see it both ways. There certainly is the argument that, yes, he's possessed by the Phoenix Force, and that's why he does the things that he does. But he does something in Avengers versus X-Men that is wildly out of character. He basically crosses a line that you can't come back from in a lot of people's minds. And so,
yeah.
That it was a polarizing thing when it happened at the time. And so if you haven't read Avengers versus X-Men and you plan to, and you know what I'm talking about here, John Paul, right?
Yeah.
Sorry, because I don't want
to. Should I spoil it? Or
yeah, no. Yeah, go ahead. Tell us what the line he crosses, and tell us how you felt like about Cyclops and about that happening. Did it ring true to in the story for you, or did it seem forced?
I actually still don't know how I feel. Well, you know, like you said, having an out, having being possessed by the Phoenix Force was made it plausible, because, you know, Professor X and Cyclops were close for years and years. Like, as you alluded to earlier, almost a teacher's pet kind of relationship. So for him to kill Professor X, that was pretty dark, you know. He crossed the line for sure. And even with what's going on now in the X-Men, I don't think fans have forgiven that. Some fans, I have, but
yeah, it I mean, it just, you, so many times you saw where you'd have a situation like this, somebody's completely mad with power. And the thing that brings them back is seeing, you know, a loved one, or, you know, somebody can kind of get through to them. That is not what happened here. Cyclops saw Professor X, said, "You know what? You're done." And bam. And it just happened. It was, I guess the thing I didn't like about it, I mean, like you, I could buy in that, okay, Phoenix Force, he's overwhelmed by it. He certainly isn't as equipped mentally to handle it as Jean Grey was. And ultimately she couldn't handle it either. And so you could see Cyclops being more easily overcome by the Phoenix Force to the point where he would do something like this. The thing that I didn't like about it mostly is it just felt like it was done for shock value. You know, that's what I didn't necessarily like about it. Like, it's like, we need to kill somebody big. We need to kill Professor X, and we're going to have Cyclops of all people do it. But I get it from the aspect of wanting to do something interesting with Cyclops as a character. And so it certainly did that. And so Cyclops at the end of Avengers versus X-Men is taken prisoner by the Avengers once the Phoenix Force has left his body, and he eventually escapes, and that leads into the Uncanny X-Men Volume 3 by Brian Michael Bendis, where Cyclops gets a new costume, and he's all of a sudden he's more of an anti-hero now. Like, he's like a Punisher, you know, the Marvel Universe mutant version of the Punisher, where he's going to do whatever he needs to do to keep mutant kind safe. And, you know, he's much more, you know, a Magneto than a Professor X. You know, all of a sudden he's agreeing with Magneto that whatever needs to be done needs to be done. And so that's basically where he is until we get to the death of X, which we're going to talk about in a second. But before we get to that, I do want to talk about the costume, because so more so than anybody else, Cyclops had a costume that resembled like the original X-Men costume, like from back in the 60s, right? Like when the school first opened, when you first saw the X-Men comic, it was the
yellow
black
and blue.
Yeah, well, so black costume, actually, black and yellow, but in comics back in the day, you couldn't really do flat black on the old newspaper kind of print. So like Fantastic Four costume, you look at that, oh, that's supposed to be black, but it looked dark blue. And then eventually, yeah, okay, it's blue, basically. Same thing with Spider-Man's costume. Spider-Man's costume is technically supposed to be black and red, but, right. You know, because of the printing restrictions at the time and stuff, became blue and red, so whatever. But anyway, over time, so the original five, they all had the black or blue, however you want to look at it, and yellow costume. And then, except for Jean Grey, who had a green mini dress and a yellow mask, but whatever, it's fine.
She started out with the
she did, you're right, she did have blue and yellow for a few issues. Yeah, you're right. But anyway, even so, over time, you know, Beast left and Angel left, and you know, they came in and out of the X-Men. Iceman left at various times, but then you had the giant size X-Men come in when they stopped doing the reprints. You introduced those, Dave Cockrum, and, you know, Nightcrawler and Colossus and Wolverine and Storm, and Sunfire was there for that first adventure. Thunderbird. I was going to say Thunderstrike. I knew that wasn't right. Yeah, Thunderbird. So, but they all had their own unique costumes, and it was a much more diverse look. But Cyclops, he's still wearing that old school, you know, school uniform, if you will, with the blue and the yellow and the visor. And so he hung on to that for such a long time. And even over the years, even when he goes to X-Factor, even when he comes back to the X-Men in the 90s, you had the jacket era, in the early 2000s, it was always a bluish costume, dark blue costume, the yellow visor, the yellow gloves, the yellow boots. It was always very similar. You know, even though a lot of the other characters had different costumes that changed here, you know, here and there in 90s, whatever, but not Cyclops, man. He always just that old school costume. And if it wasn't quite old school, it was tweaked here or there, but it was still recognizable. It was still that same color scheme. So after Avengers versus X-Men, I guess to signify how different he's become, they create this black and red costume for him with an X on the face instead of the visor. And I think it's one of the stupidest looking costumes I've ever seen in my entire life in the history of comics. Mostly because of that X over the face. It just looks so stupid. I absolutely hate it. I remember the first time I saw it, I was like, what the fuck? Like, what? You have these incredibly talented artists, and this is the best they could come up with? I don't mind them changing the color scheme to black and red, you know, kind of signaling that he's went over to this dark side. But I don't understand the no eye kind of thing and the X over the eye. Like, I never understand. Like, are you trying to say he's blinded by X? He's blinded by mutants, like he's blinded by his desire to say. Like, I didn't understand if there was an ulterior motive in making it look like that. All I could think when I looked at it was, God, does that costume look stupid? And he had it for years.
years and years, I just like the way people feel, some people feel about Superman, the electric blue Superman, and how bad that looks and changing the powers, whatever. They didn't change Cyclops' powers here, but the way people despise the look of Superman is the way I despise this look of Cyclops and this costume. I don't know. How did you feel about it? I mean, did it make any difference to you?
When I initially saw it, I did not like it. I too was like, what's with this big old X on his face? I missed the visor, like, instantly. What, the visor, it's like, I grew into it. I like that it was different, but, you know, I never fell in love with it, but I never hated it.
Yeah, I mean, it almost felt, maybe they're trying to embrace the Cyclops fit, you know, the one-eyed kind of thing. Because even, right. You know, even when he used to have the visor, I mean, it was one eye, but it would be kind of long. And now it also seemed like, whenever he used his optic blast, it came out of the middle of the X, like the intersection. So it was more like a single beam, more like a Cyclops of mythology, if you will. But I never liked it. And maybe it's because it covered up so much more of his face that I felt like he wasn't. I mean, I guess maybe it didn't necessarily cover more of his face than his original one. It just felt like it was less expressive to me. I just didn't like it. Maybe it reminded me too much of like a Xenobite, whatever they're called from the Hellraiser series. For some reason,
I've seen it.
It's the Clive Barker movies.
I've heard of it.
Yeah, it's just I didn't like the costume. And so one thing that is interesting in this X-Men annual, which I promise we're going to get to, is that it was a big departure that he goes back to his old costume. So it does signal sort of a return to form of Cyclops, if you will, redemption. So, but we'll talk about that in a second. But before we get to the resurrection in this Uncanny X-Men annual, we got to talk about how he died, which happens in the Death of X series from 2016. And this spins out of the, or is a part of, I guess you'd say, the Inhumans versus X-Men kind of thing that's been going on. And this is something else that's interesting. You kind of wonder, and even fans of the MCU and Marvel Cinematic, you kind of wonder if an event like this ever would have come down if Disney had owned Fox sooner. Because it certainly feels to me, felt like at the time, still feels like to me, the whole reason that Marvel was trying to shove the Inhumans down our throats and put the X-Men on the back burner was because of Ike Perlmutter and his dislike of Fox and the falling out that he had with, you know, between the movie studios. And they didn't want Ike basically issued an ultimatum, even though he denied it. It's since been, they've shown memos and such, and everybody basically knows it happened. He said, no Fantastic Four comics. We want to limit X-Men comics as much as possible. No X-Men posters, no merchandise, no toys, no statues, nothing. We don't want to promote these properties. We don't want to promote the Fantastic Four. We don't want to promote the X-Men because it's making it's basically us spending our dollars to promote these characters that will benefit another movie studio who won't do what I'm telling them to do. So that's why the X-Men were kind of, it felt like Marvel was trying to take them off the scene, off the page, and replace them with the Inhumans. And I've talked about it a lot of times on the podcast about how the reason the X-Men became so popular, it happened organically. You can't just shove them off to the side and say, okay, now learn about the Inhumans and those will be the cool people. You got to tell the stories over years, and organically they have to become popular. And so, you know, it was the Infinity series from Jonathan Hickman starring Thanos, where, and again, it's super convoluted and a lot of different things happen. But to make a long story short, the Terrigen Mists, which is basically, think of it as the inhuman version of the X gene. It's what triggers the latent hidden abilities of these inhumans who are a little bit different genetically than regular humans. And it's what triggers their abilities and gives them their powers. And so, come to find out, because the Inhumans had been a relatively small group prior to this.
Right.
But then, with, you know, Perlmutter's ultimatum, they have the idea, the powers that be have to come up with an idea of how the Inhumans are going to take over for the mutants. And so their idea was, okay, it's been unknown previously, but it's come to find out there are Inhumans all over the world, and Inhumans have intermarried and such with, you know, regular humans, non-powered humans. And there's actually all these people that have these Inhuman traits that can be triggered by the Terrigen Mist. And the only reason they just live as human and don't know any better is because they're never exposed to the Terrigen Mist, and it's never, their powers have never manifested. So the Terrigen Mist previously had always been tightly controlled by the royal family, Black Bolt and Medusa, and those, the ruling class of the Inhumans. But through the events of the Infinity series, the Terrigen Mist gets disseminated around the globe, and there's all these Inhumans popping up left and right, hundreds if not thousands of them. And that's basically how Marvel is going to editorially say, okay, you can now get rid of mutants because now we have hundreds of Inhumans to take their place in term, you know, for purposes of storytelling, in terms of having characters to tell stories about. And I don't know how I thought this was actually going to work. You could really get rid of these beloved characters and replace them with new characters, but whatever. So this is what's happening in the Marvel universe. Now, even though many, 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 many times mutants previously had been exposed to Terrigen Mist and it did not kill them, even purposely exposed to the Terrigen Mist by Quicksilver. We talked about House of M earlier. All but 198 of the mutants in the Marvel Universe lose their powers. Quicksilver, who was married to Crystal, who's an Inhuman, knows about the Terrigen Mist, thinks, oh, maybe we can expose mutants to Terrigen Mist and that will fix, quote-unquote, fix them now that they've lost their powers. So, and Quicksilver exposed hundreds of mutants to Terrigen Mist. Nothing happened. Didn't give them back their powers, but didn't kill them. Nothing happened. So it's been a lot of times that mutants have been exposed to Terrigen Mist. But again, Ike wants the X-Men off the page. And when this got leaked out, they did sort of change some things editorially, because originally it was rumored that all the mutants were going to leave. They were going to either, Marvel's going to shove them off onto a different planet and kind of forget about them, or a different dimension. It didn't go that far. But basically what happens is Terrigen Mist, it has been released, it's covering the globe, and all of a sudden it's lethal to mutants. And at least Marvel doesn't completely ignore the fact that in the past it hasn't been. There is like a couple of throwaway lines in one issue of Death of X where Cyclops says something like, well, Hank McCoy's been studying it, and he thinks that this widespread distribution of Terrigen Mist has interacted with the Earth's atmosphere in some way and changed the mists chemically, the way it's actually constructed. It has changed it slightly to the point where it's now lethal to mutants. It's like M-Pox, I think they call it. It kills mutants now. And so this is the way Marvel is going to, okay, all the X-Men have to leave Earth. They have to go away because this Terrigen Mist is lethal to mutants. So in the Death of X series, and again, this is super spoilery for Death of X, so if you want to read it, you probably want to come back to this podcast at a later time. But basically what happens is Cyclops discovers this. It starts this Inhuman versus X-Men battle, this war, because, you know, Cyclops is already, as we've said, kind of in the militant mindset, wants to protect mutants. And so he's basically saying, he insinuates that the Inhumans have done this on purpose, even though there's never been any bad blood between Inhumans and mutants before. It doesn't make any sense for that to happen. Again, I'm going to chalk it up to Cyclops paranoia. But basically what happens is there's a big battle, and supposedly Cyclops finds a way to use another character's ability to change the Terrigen Mist chemically, so that it no longer is harmful for mutants, and it no longer triggers the Inhuman ability to gain powers. And Black Bolt doesn't like that, and Black Bolt, one of the most powerful characters in the Marvel Universe, basically opens his mouth and kills Cyclops. Like, I can't remember. I don't think he actually says a word. And like most of the time, when Black Bolt opens his mouth, he says like one little tiny word and it blows somebody. But I think it was just a picture of him just maybe just screamed or something. And Cyclops is dead, and he becomes a smarter for mutant kind. Except not really. All that stuff, the big battle, the big fight, changing the Terrigen Mist, none of that actually happens. What actually happens is right at the beginning, when Cyclops discovers that the mist is harmful to mutants, he's exposed to it, he goes back to a lab on Muir Island with Emma Frost, who's his girlfriend at the time. Remember, Jean Grey's dead, and dies right there. Just as he's exposed, he starts coughing, he falls, he develops a little pox on his face and just dies. And Emma Frost, a couple of things, you know, we talked about how manipulative she is, and she's also, you know, stricken with grief for the fact that she just lost this man that she loves as much as Emma Frost can ever love anyone more than herself. And so she uses her mental powers to make everybody think that this other event happened and Cyclops died a martyr, because she does not believe that he should have died the way that he did. And there were a lot of X-Men fans who felt the same way, that, well, here's like one of maybe the greatest X-Men ever in terms of being the first. And yeah, he's kind of gone off the rails a little bit over the last couple of years, but he deserved a more heroic death than he inhaled some poison gas, fell over and died in a lab with nobody there. It wasn't a heroic death, anticlimactic kind of thing or whatever. So I thought it was kind of interesting that they did it that way. I didn't like it. I didn't dislike it. Because at that point, that was a phase where I just really didn't like what Marvel had done with Colossus. Didn't like the costume. Didn't like the fact that, like, I guess maybe it made me realize I never appreciated the Cyclops from before, that I did find sort of one-dimensional and not that interesting. But then when they turned him into this pseudo bad guy who was a real dick, I actively disliked him. So then it did make me appreciate the Cyclops from before. And so, yeah, I thought that was an interesting way to kill him. And I could see the point and why Emma Frost did what she did to make everybody think he died a heroic death. But honestly, I was just kind of glad he was dead, because they'd fucked him up so much. Pardon my French there. But how did you feel about it? Him being killed, Jean-Paul? What did you think about Death of X?
I say, well, since he was a character that's been so far gone in a lot of people's eyes, I think it was an appropriate time, because you even when you kill a character, you know, especially one as big as Cyclops, that they're going to bring him back after they figure out what to do with him. So I didn't think it was necessary, but I see why they would do it.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you, and it's, I mean, maybe more so than anybody else, it's the X-Men who get killed and come back in the Marvel Universe.
Yeah, and well, that's why what's happening now with the X-Men is I think a good idea, but we'll get into that later.
Yeah, definitely. So interesting, you know, Jean Grey had died in 2004. And she didn't come back until, what, 2017, late 2017. So she was actually gone for like 13.
But that was.
Yeah, a long time.
Yeah, and that was not even the first time that she died.
So. Right, exactly. And so she was maybe the one that lasted the longest. Wolverine, we got, what, maybe 5 years out of him. Although, was he ever really gone? Because you had Old Man Logan, and you had Dakin, and you had X-23. So he wasn't really gone that much. And kind of the same thing with Jean. You had Rachel Summers. You had Hope Summers. You had other people kind of filling that role. Plus, you also had, again, X-Men convoluted, whatever. Maybe Jean Grey or Cyclops comes back sooner. But you had Beast going back in time and bringing the original five X-Men back, you know. And so you still had a Cyclops. X-Men history, just so convoluted. So you just wonder if, but I say all that to say that really, when you think about it, Cyclops wasn't really gone that long.
No, but especially in comparison to the other characters.
Yeah, exactly. And so, I mean, it was, yeah. this annual was what, January 2019? A little over a year ago. Cyclops had died in 2016. So only about 3 years, but long enough. And certainly the X-Men, even though they weren't taken completely off the table,
like we said, despite Ike Perlmutter's request or desire, they certainly did have much less of an impact, much less of a footprint in the Marvel Universe until Marvel started deciding to clean things up. And with hindsight, it's easy to say, oh, well, that was when Hickman signed on to do this House of X, Powers of X, Dawn of X sort of reboot of the entire X-Men universe. And we still don't really know what his end game is yet. We're still in the midst of it. But basically what they started putting things back, they put the original five X-Men, they restored the timeline. You had Jean Grey in the Phoenix Resurrection come back, which that story ties into this annual we're going to talk about. And then you had the Uncanny X-Men relaunch, where all the other, the X-Men Gold, X-Men Blue, X-Men Red all ended, all three of those series ended, and all the characters were folded into that Uncanny X-Men story that ran in the weekly, the 10 issues that were released weekly, that basically told the story of X-Man coming and trying to create a mutant utopia, and then the age of X-Man that spins out of that. And then after that, we have the Jonathan Hickman stuff. So it was the right time. Everything was being reset and restored. And this Uncanny X-Men annual was basically, okay, we've got Jean back. We've got the original five X-Men back in their proper timeline. And now it's time to bring... Oh, and I should also mention the return of Wolverine, because he had been dead for a little while. He had come back. And now it was time to bring Cyclops back. So that's where this annual starts. That's the context and the backstory. And again, I know it gets like really convoluted, but if you're an X-Men fan, you're following along with us here. So the credits for this Uncanny X-Men annual, written by Ed Brisson, art is by Carlos Gomez, colors are by Guru EFX, and letters are by Joe Caramagna. And it starts off, and we see the grave on Muir Island of Scott Summers. It reads, Scott Summers, Cyclops, teacher, warrior, hero, mutant. He fought for us, is what it says. And it actually, the little blurb here, the little dialogue box says, this was several weeks ago. The ground starts rumbling, and we get a big scrack as what looks to be a very familiar scene to X-Men fans. It's an optic blast. And Cyclops comes crawling out of his grave in that terrible costume. Not bad enough they made him wear it when he was alive. They buried him in the damn thing. How horrible.
And, maybe that was symbolism.
Oh, my God. So bad. So bad. Yeah. Please shed that skin. Shed that costume like a snake. Leave it behind. And he's asking the question as he climbs out of the grave, the same question that we all have on our minds. How? How is he coming back? Because... he was killed by the Terrigen Mist, as I said, and he doesn't have any of the boils or pox or whatever on his face either. He looks fully healthy. So as we turn the page, it's kind of a stark visual contrast. They make it look like an old comic, like where it looks pixelated with the colors and such. And it says Cambridge, Massachusetts, several years ago. And I love that they put it several years ago, because it's actually a really long time ago when you want to talk about publishing history. And basically, Cambridge, Massachusetts, so close to the Xavier School for gifted students. And Cyclops, this is when he's still probably high school or college age, is walking down the street near Cambridge. There's a giant robot that's attacking the library. And Cyclops ends up saving the day by discovering it's some professor from the school who has been fired by the school. And he created this robot, and he's controlling it through this helmet that he's wearing. And apparently a student had complained about that doesn't really go into detail. It just says big ideas. The students were afraid of my big ideas, so they went to the dean and had me fired. And they took my job and everything I cared about. And so he's trying to get revenge on the students. And so when Cyclops basically blasts the little controller helmet that this professor is wearing, what's his name? Professor Tevin something or other. But anyway, the robot falls to the ground, and the police come and they cordon off the the area, and one of the police officers says, "Yeah, I know some people think mutants are a menace, but you know, thanks, you saved a lot of these kids' lives." And some of the kids come up to Cyclops and they say, "Thanks, we thought for sure we were goners." Yeah, Professor Tierney, that's his name, Professor Tavin Tierney. Yeah, and it was a shame. He was so smart. If only to use that big old brain of his for good. And then one particular student comes up and says that his name is Paul Duick, and he was the one that actually he says, "I ratted out or ratted on Professor Tavin Tierney to the faculty, and it was me who's after. Thanks for saving me. You know, I'm married and we're expecting our first child, and if I'd gotten killed," and he just says, "You know, thank you. If there's ever anything you need, if I can ever repay the favor." So clearly, he's very appreciative and thankful to Cyclops for saving his life. So then we fast forward 10 years later, and it says a favor. You know, go ahead.
That 10 years.
Yeah, right?
I don't know. I just didn't expect to see like a modern car and everything. I don't know. Anyway, continue.
Yeah, well, the other part is, I mean, when you want to talk about maybe when this was supposed to take place, it would have been in the early X-Men issues, so before they went into reprint. So say, I don't know, issue 30 of Uncanny X-Men or so, you know, the very first volume, like back in the 60s. And then you fast forward 10 years, and 10 years in Marvel time, and we've had everything happen. The entire, you know, new X-Men, the entire giant size X-Men, you know, all the events, everything, like 10 years have passed in Marvel history, but more like, what, 50 years have passed in publishing history? Because when you say 10 years later and you're in Boston, Massachusetts, Cyclops is dead now. Or actually not dead. He's almost, we're going to get there, but it's within a couple of years. So you're talking about 40 to 50 years of actual real time passing publishing time, but only 10 years in the Marvel universe. So basically this house that we're outside of is Paul Duick's house. The young Cable is there. And he has this box that the Avengers had that they were going to try to use to contain the Phoenix Force. It's called the Phoenix Cage. And Cable basically says, "Hey, do you remember when Cyclops saved your life? Well, now it's time to return the favor." And Paul Duick's like, "What do you mean? What does this have to do with Cyclops? I'm going to call the police. Like, who are you? Why are you in my house?" And Cable's trying to explain, "Well, first of all, I cut your phone lines and I cut your alarms. You're not calling anybody. And yeah, it's time to repay that favor. In a couple of years, I'm going to need this Phoenix cage rebuilt. Oh, and I'm also going to need it about that big, because it's probably the size of, I don't know, maybe an Xbox, maybe a little bit bigger.
Like a microwave."
Yeah, a microwave. That's a good analogy. But Cable's like, "No, I need it to be really, really small." And apparently, Paul Duick's like, "What? I can't do that. Is it even possible? It's supposed to trap the Phoenix Force?" And Cable's like, "It doesn't have to trap the whole Phoenix Force. And you have 2 years. It just has to siphon off, you know, a little bit of the energy. And it has to be really small. I'll see you in 2 years." And he tries to, before he leaves, he tries to, kind of assuage Paul's worries that he won't be able to do this by saying, "Hey, you were top of your class at MIT. You're the smartest guy at Stark Enterprises. So, you know, there's a reason I picked you. You can do it." And he body slides by two. So Paul Duick's working on that for 2 years. Now we fast forward 2 years, and now Scott's dead. So in that 2 year period, so we figure the event, that event happened, you know, pretty soon, or, you know, within a year or two of Cyclops dying. So we fast forward 2 years, we're on Muir Island, and it says the first time Scott Summers died. As far as we know, Scott's only ever died once. And this is the time that he died from the Terrigen Mist, and the whole Death of X thing with Emma Frost showing the world, or tricking the world into believing he died this heroic death. And so we see a bunch of the X-Men that are around his grave, and Storm's giving the eulogy. "Life as a mutant sometimes feels like a constant fight for our species' survival against impossible odds." And they're basically having the funeral. Now, the rest of the X-Men don't see, but Cable is there. The young Cable is there. He's hiding behind some gravestones. with Paul Duick, and Paul Duick saying, he's really gone. And the younger Cable saying, yeah. And Paul's like, I know people had really hated him. He'd recently gone off the rails, obviously referring to what we were talking about that started in Avengers versus X-Men, and then him being possessed by the Phoenix Force, killing Xavier, like all that stuff. Not only were comic fans like, why did you do this? We hate that you changed Cyclops. But even in the Marvel Universe itself, people were aware that Cyclops had kind of gone off the rails and people were disliking him. And Paul Duick goes on to say, I was kept hoping he'd come to his senses. He'd remember who he was. You know, again, is it the Phoenix Force possessing him that corrupted him? And even after the Phoenix Force left, there were lingering effects. But this is the line that Paul Duick says that kind of gives you the first inkling that maybe this is a way to reset Cyclops, if you will. He says, you know, I was hoping that I'd wake up one day and Cyclops would be that same kid who saved my life in college. And so basically what happens is they're not actually burying a body out there, apparently. They think they are, but again, it's all the manipulation of what Emma Frost, the White Queen, is doing. And so when they actually body slide by two, Cable and Paul Duick, they go into the lab in Muir Island where Cyclops died. We see his body. It's all desiccated and jacked up from the Terrigen Mist. And they basically cut him open and they implant that little miniaturized Phoenix Force cage. Paul Duick was actually able to make it, to miniaturize it. And Cable asks him, are you sure this will work? He says, no, I have no way to test it. But I tried to account for the extra surge of the power, and in theory it should work, but it could easily overload and fail. I guess it just depends on the intensity of the Phoenix Force. And Cable said, well, the last time the Phoenix Force was trying to protect itself and it blew out that old cage, this time when it's going to go into this cage, it's going to be giving itself willingly. It's willingly going to enter that cage, unbeknownst to the Phoenix Force itself. So maybe that'll be the difference. And when we turn the page, this is actually only several months ago. And this is from some of the events of the Phoenix Resurrection when Jean Grey returned. And we're not going to get into that in any detail whatsoever. I'm just going to say that the Phoenix Force had decided to resurrect Jean Grey, reconstruct her body, because it realized that she was the only being in the Marvel multiverse that could handle being bonded with the Phoenix Force, and the Phoenix Force wants to be bonded with somebody. So any chance of being with Hope Summers or whoever else didn't matter. The Phoenix Force wanted Jean Grey. It brought Jean Grey back to life, and Jean Grey rejected it. She was strong enough to reject it, but kind of the final temptation, if you will, of Jean Grey during that Phoenix Resurrection series, because the Phoenix Force was trying to show her, hey, if you bond with us, if you accept the Phoenix Force, we can bring your parents back. We can bring back all these other people that have been killed. And she keeps rejecting it. No, no, no. The Phoenix Force isn't meant to be held by a mortal being. And the final step that the Phoenix Force takes is to resurrect Scott Summers and try to show Jean Grey, hey, if you accept the Phoenix Force, you can have your husband back. So the Cable, and again, Cable, time traveler, knew about this happening. So that's the whole idea of having Paul Duick create this Phoenix cage, make it much smaller so they can implant it in Scott's body, so that when Scott Summers is resurrected by the Phoenix Force goes into him, some of the power, some of the energy of the Phoenix Force will be trapped in that cage. It won't overload. It won't short it out, because again, the Phoenix Force is going into Scott willingly, choosing to go into Scott and resurrect him. And that when the Phoenix Force then leaves him, as it does when Jean rejects the Phoenix Force for the final time in the Phoenix Resurrection miniseries, that some of that residual energy from the Phoenix Force will remain in that miniature cage and will bring Scott back to life. And that's exactly what happened. So apparently after that happened, so I don't know if it was the White Queen or Paul Duick and Cable, but somebody eventually takes that desiccated body of Cyclops and they do bury it in that grave where they were having the funeral. And I guess they just leave it sitting there. And again, you got to kind of take it with a grain of salt. Why would they do that? Why would Cable bury his father
with the miniaturized phoenix cage in his chest if he knew he was going to come back to life. Again, just take it for what it is. It allows them to have that cool scene where Cyclops is blasting his way out of the grave at the beginning of the issue. So that's how Cyclops physically comes back. And Paul Duick and Cable are there when Cyclops climbs out of the grave, and Cable says, "Welcome back, Dad." And obviously, Cyclops is pretty confused. Cable, because it's a much younger version of Cable than he's been used to seeing before. So we turn the page. We're at Cable's safe house, undisclosed location. And Cyclops is thanking them for bringing him back to life. And Paul Duick's saying, "Hey, when you saved my life all those years ago, I never thought I'd actually have the idea to pay you back. So I'm grateful for that. I can't believe that it worked." And Cyclops is saying, "Yeah, I'm still not sure what happened. Last thing I remember, I was walking into the lab on Muir Island, and then I think I died. But then I remember having a dream that I was alive again, and Jean was there." And obviously that's a reference to when he was brought back to life by the Phoenix Force in that Phoenix Resurrection miniseries. And Cyclops is explaining, "Well, the Phoenix Force tried to tempt Jean by bringing you back to life, but she was too strong. But, you know, we built this machine and it siphoned off some of the energy, and it stored that energy inside this device, and that was able to bring you back to life." And again, Cyclops says, "Thanks, you know, I really appreciate it." Paul Duick says, I wanted to say thank you. I have a life. I have a son. If you hadn't saved me, you know, my son never would have known his father." And we see the look on Cyclops' face, and clearly there's more father-son stuff going on here with Cyclops and Cable as well. So 1 week later, we see that Cyclops is finally out of that god-awful costume, and he's trying to get Cable to release him, saying, "Hey, I need to go. I need to see Jean." And Cable's saying, "You can't." And Cyclops is getting frustrated. "You can't keep me cooped up in here. You know, I appreciate what you've done bringing me back to life, but I've been gone too long." And Cable's saying, "You're not ready yet," because he hasn't really explained to Cyclops what's been going on with, you know, the younger X-Men being, or the young X-Men having been brought forward in time and then taken, finally gone back to their own time, and what X-Men has been doing. And Cable just says, "You'll know when the time comes. You'll know." Because Cyclops is like, I what am I supposed to be ready for? So meanwhile, another week goes by, and we see that Professor Tevin Tierney is finally released from prison. It's been 13 years for him, apparently. And he heads right back to his old house, basement, and starts up his evil ways once again. He wants to get revenge on Paul Duick for basically costing him 13 years of his life. Meanwhile, back at the safe house, Cable's explaining to Cyclops that he sent back the younger version of the X-Men. And Cyclops says, "Yeah, I know. It's like I experienced it. I was there. I have his memories now. The timeline has been restored, if you will." And Cable's saying, "Yeah, they never should have been there in the first place." And Cyclops is trying to understand, "Yeah, you killed your older self. You killed Cable. You killed my son." And he's like, "No, I am your son. And I just retired a less effective version of myself." Which I'm still not sure how I feel about that, but that's a podcast for a different day. The fact that
he says that every time somebody accuses him of killing his younger self. Yeah, so.
No, I retired. I was like, I kind of like the older version. This new version. I don't know. Maybe it's just as I get older, I don't like the younger characters that act like punks. Why I can't stand Damian Wayne, and this Cable, this younger Cable feels to be the same. But anyway, he says, I fixed the timeline. The old Cable was letting them stay here. It was could have destroyed not only this universe, but all the universes, all the futures. And I stopped that by sending them back because that's my job. And I'm supposed to keep the timeline in order. And Cyclops is like, "Well, then how come I'm not still dead? Like, I died. And if you're supposed to not be changing things, why did you bring me back?" And this is one of the most meta things I've ever seen in a comic. And Cable says, "Because you couldn't have died like that. It wasn't right. You're their leader. You're their hope. And you died on your knees from a damn mist. That's not how it should have gone down. I couldn't let it end that way." And so it's really cathartic, I think, the way they brought them back. Great job by Matt Rosenberg to throw this in there and basically, you know, give
voice to all those X-Men fans, or not Matt Rosenberg, sorry, Ed Brisson, who wrote it, who wrote this issue, to basically give voice to all those fans who said, Cyclops should not have gone out like that. It was dumb, basically. How could you let this heroic mainstay of the Marvel Universe die from some mist and not go out like a hero defending the ideals that he believed in? And so, I mean, I guess it makes sense. I mean, this is Cable. This is his father. So, again, it makes a lot of sense. And Cyclops himself agrees. He's like, you know what? You're right. Like, if I had the chance to save somebody I loved, then I probably would have done whatever it takes. But I don't understand why you brought me back if you've only done it to just keep me prisoner here. He's like, there are people that need me, and you need to let me go. And it's actually time, and Cable knows that. He says, fine, but first you need to prove something to me first, because as much as Cable brought him back exactly for the reasons he said, that he didn't deserve to go out like that. It's his father. He loves him. But who did he bring back, right? Did he bring back the Cyclops of old, the noble, heroic Cyclops? Or did he bring back the most recent Cyclops who would do anything to protect mutants and was of that Magneto mindset of mutants first, always save mutants, always put the best interests of mutants above everybody, even other innocents? And so he explains to Cyclops what's going on in the world right now. He says, right now on an island in Canada, all the X-Men are fighting against X-Man, the biggest threat they've ever faced, and they need all hands on deck because they're losing. And if they lose, if they fail, the X-Men will be no more, because that's what X-Man is fighting for, to create that utopia where, and he believes, if you've read that 10-week, 10-issue Uncanny X-Men story arc, that it's always the X-Men bringing strife. And so in order to have a utopia, the X-Men need to be eliminated from existence. So the X-Men are literally fighting against this godlike version of X-Man for their very existence and the existence of mutants. But in Boston, Cable goes on to say, a madman is planning his revenge on Paul Duick, the man he holds responsible for everything that happened in his life, the guy who just helped me bring you back to life. So you can only save one. Saving one means failing the other, and you have to choose. And Cyclops says, no, this can't be. He says that, and Cable says, well, they all die. If you won't choose, then the X-Men are going to die, and Paul Duick and his family are going to die. And Cyclops wants to understand, you did this? And Cable's imploring him, choose. Cyclops still trying to understand, why would you do this? Why did you set this up this way? And Cable says, because I have to know what type of man came back from the grave. He basically wants to know what version of Cyclops came back. And so Cyclops' choice is the only choice that he really could make if he really was the Cyclops, the heroic version of Cyclops, and not this more militant mutant first version. He goes and he saves the innocent people. He goes and he saves Paul Duick and his family. But it's a little bit anticlimactic in that this 13 years that Tevin Turney spent in prison, he didn't learn anything. He's still using a helmet that's easily blasted off his head to control the robots. And Cyclops even said, you'd think after 13 years away, you'd find a way to hide your weakness. But I guess some people never learn. And Paul Duick says, I can't believe it. You saved me again. Thank you. And Cyclops says, no, Paul, thank you for bringing me back. And really, when he's saying that, I don't think he's just saying, you brought me back to life. He brought him back. This is the Cyclops that that we never knew we always wanted, to borrow a line from a movie. Because just like me, when I didn't realize how much I appreciated the old version of Cyclops until we got the newer version with the crappy costume and the bad attitude. But this seems much more like the heroic Cyclops of old, and maybe one who will be a little more interesting now that he has this introspective nature and realizes and has gone through this trauma. He'll be a little more mellow, if you will, a little more like a little wiser you know, a little more appreciative of what he has as well. So the next day, we see that Cable and Cyclops have traveled to that island in Canada. The fight is over, and all the X-Men are gone. And Cable or Cyclops is saying, you know, the fight with the Avengers, it started with the first punch that was thrown on a beach. When Charles died, when I killed Charles, that was on a beach. And now the X-Men are gone. They vanished from this very beach we're on. Like, man, if I never see another beach as long as I live. And Cyclops is trying to explain. He's like, man, I was so furious. And really, this goes back to what we talked about before with House of M. Furious that it looked like mutants were on the verge of extinction. They went from having thousands of mutants to Scarlet Witch saying no more mutants and down to only 198. And Cyclops goes on to say, I was angry that the world we'd spent our whole lives trying to protect could just snuff us out like that. You know, I'd spent a life trying to prove that we fit in, that humans and mutants could live together in harmony. And then, you know, I threw that all away and I did the same thing that all the people I'd been fighting against had done. You know, followed the same path that Magneto had followed. I put my species, I put mutants above theirs, and I became the very thing that I hated and I feared. And it was wrong. I was wrong. So again, Paul Duick not only brought him back, but he's brought back the Cyclops from before all the trauma, from before House of M, from before Death of X, from before Avengers versus X-Men. And you really wonder, was any residual corruption by the Phoenix Force when Cyclops was part of the Phoenix Five, was any of that purged when he died? It was kind of like, you know, resetting a computer, if you will, or something like that. But you kind of want, but can you reset the Phoenix Force if there was corruption by him being resurrected by the Phoenix Force? It would make more sense if he was resurrected in a different way. But be that as it may, it seems like we have the old version, the old heroic classic version of Cyclops back. And he's obviously sad that the X-Men are gone. He's finally back to himself, feels like his own self, but now they're gone. So Cable asks him, what are you going to do about it? And he says, I guess I'm going to find the X-Men and set it right. And this is going to continue in Matthew Rosenberg's Uncanny X-Men run, the 10-issue weekly series Uncanny X-Men, with that story arc of going up against X-Man. Was the first 10 issues of Uncanny X-Men written by Brisson, Matt Rosenberg, and Kelly Thompson. But when you go over to X-Men number 11, starting with issue 11, it's Matt Rosenberg writing on his own. So we'll cover those in future X Tuesdays as well. So that's the issue. I thought it was an interesting way to bring him back. Really wrapped up in the Phoenix Force, which I guess when you're talking about bringing X-Men back, it's sort of the easiest way to do it. Certainly how they brought Jean Grey back, which made sense. Cool idea, the way they used it here. The only thing I didn't like about it, like I just mentioned, was the fact that Cyclops is reset from corruption that supposedly happened to him while he was possessed by the Phoenix Force. But that corruption is reset by him being resurrected. But it would have made more sense if he was resurrected in some other way than the Phoenix Force itself. Because how does the Phoenix Force reset corruption that it itself caused, if you know what I'm saying? But it's a small nitpicky thing. I did enjoy the issue. I thought the art by Carlos Gomez was really cool. I loved how this annual really ties in a lot of things that have happened over the past 15, 20 years of the X-Men, from House of M to Avengers versus X-Men to X-Men versus Inhumans, like all that. I mean, we had to touch on so many different aspects of X-Men history just to kind of make sure that you guys all understand exactly the events leading up to Cyclops' death, his resurrection. So in the back, there is additional reading. It mentions Secret Avengers 26, which I think is where the Avengers create that microwave size Phoenix cage. It talks about reading Phoenix Resurrection number one, which I really enjoyed that miniseries from Matt Rosenberg. Also, the Extermination miniseries by Ed Brisson is one of my favorite X series. It's only 5 issues from the last few years. And then Death of X as well, which obviously explains how Cyclops died. So there's a lot you can read to get more out of this Uncanny X-Men annual number one. Obviously, House of M, Avengers versus X-Men, like all the stuff we touched on is all good and interesting, and will provide context for this this resurrection. But I liked it. I liked it more than I thought. One of the things Marvel did was they didn't spring this as a surprise. You know, a lot of times they bring somebody back, they won't necessarily let us know. But this was announced. I remember seeing the cover, and they talked about the story at New York City Comic Con, October 2018, and when the issue didn't come out till January of 2019. So 3 months ahead of time, we knew this was coming. Didn't know exactly how it was going to happen, but I felt that it all made sense. And I was honestly just glad to have the Cyclops back that I really didn't know that I had missed until we got that jerky Cyclops with the terrible costume. So what were your thoughts on the story when you first read it, John Paul, and now that you've had time to kind of absorb it, and also you're, you know, current with X stories, looking back on it with that perspective?
Well, one thing that that I think you should mention is that in this one, he did say that he has all his past memories from the younger self that was brought back by Beast to essentially teach him a lesson, show him what he could become. So he has those memories, and I think that's another reason why he has changed and he's back to the way Cyclops used to be. I think that in combination with everything else that happened to him, yeah, gets him back on the right path. But I did like this. It summed up everything without, it made it make sense. And you don't necessarily have to go back and read all the back matter to understand what's going on moving forward. And I think that's what a good story does. You know, you don't necessarily have to read what came before it, but it helps make sense of what did come before it.
Yeah, that's a good point. Because, yeah, obviously, I even mentioned it when I was doing the recap that, yeah, once the younger or original version, or however you want to put it, of Cyclops got sent back and Cable restored the time zone, you know, this resurrected version of Cyclops says, yes, I have all his memories now. But yeah, I never put that together, though, that, yeah, that could be part of the reason. Now he's got that perspective. He's got memories of the way his younger self saw his jerky self, you know, his terrible costume version self. He's basically seen himself through his own eyes, but the eyes of himself when he had a different perspective. So that could have been very well part of the reason why he's able to pull himself back and realize the mistakes that he made. Yeah, that's a really good point. But it also brings up this point. So was Beast right? I mean, that's the whole reason the Beast said he was bringing forward the original five, was to remind the older versions why they're doing what they were doing. And specifically because Beast saw the path that Cyclops was on. So would you say, I always thought it was kind of a failure. Didn't really seem to work, because it certainly didn't change Cyclops. Didn't change his perspective
in that moment.
In that, yeah. Right. But now looking
going
at
forward,
it,
maybe.
Well, what I mean, I'm not current. I'm not current on X stuff. So, I mean, would you say you are? So, would you say that it, like, with that perspective, you think it worked? You think bringing the younger versions forward was a success?
I think so, because, well, not a complete success, because obviously they shouldn't have been out of the timeline in the first place, and that's why the whole extermination story had to be told. But I think once they were put back in their current timeline, it gave him more perspective, and with everything else that he felt like what he was doing, the current trajectory of his life, even though he died, was not the way to go. So I think it's a combination of things, but I think Beast had somewhat of a success, if that makes sense.
Yeah, maybe not as successful as it could have been. Sure, it took a long time. I mean, I felt like there were two versions.
Oh, and going forward, like in current X-Men, to me, it seems like Scott is a lot more laid back.
Yeah, which again, I just think that's a
which
plus.
Is not is typical.
Yeah, and I think it's a plus for the character. Like if he can, it's added some perspective where he can not be, because that was one of the things that just used to annoy me about him was if, you know, they were doing like a danger room session and somebody cracked a joke, he would get all pissed off and, you know, it just was like, dude, you just need to chill out a little bit. And so maybe him being dead, you know, chilled him out a little bit. I mean, one can hope. So maybe it's just, you know, as you get older, you realize what's important and you can let the little things go. I don't know.
Right.
But I thought it was a really great issue. I thought the art by Carlos Gomez, as I said, was pretty spectacular. Also, the color work. We can't discount the color work. There's a lot of bright colors by Guru EFX, especially in the pages where we get a little flashback from the Phoenix Resurrection. And particularly the pages where they make them look like it's an old comic, you know, that's done really,
yeah,
really well.
I like those.
Yeah, they're like pixelated. I mean, that's just an incredible job to really add something to the issue, because they could have just done a flashback and kept it the same. But by it really helps to age it and show that, yeah, this was really happened a long time ago, despite the story saying, hey, this was only 10 years later or 10 years prior or whatever. Really, it's 50 years in real time. But anyway. But yeah, I like that Cyclops is back. This is kind of right around. I was keeping up with X-Men stuff right up and when this issue came out. And then this is where I fell off. This is where I haven't read any of the Age of X-Men stuff. I haven't read any of the Uncanny X-Men itself, the solo series. Because again, not to spoil, but it's last year, Age of X-Men, all the X-Men have disappeared. It's sort of similar to Age of Apocalypse, where they're all in this sort of alternate reality or alternate dimension or another part of the Marvel multiverse. And there's like some minis, 5-issue minis that tell the story of that universe. Meanwhile, in the regular X title, the one I mentioned that Matthew Rosenberg takes over writing solo, that's basically Cyclops's story. Basically Uncanny X-Men becomes Cyclops series. With him trying to find out what happened to the X-Men and for them to, for Cyclops to bring them back. And then that goes into the House of X, Powers of X, Dawn of X kind of stuff, which I'm really anxious to get to. So, hopefully, and John Paul's going to have time to join me. We're going to start putting these out back to the weekly schedule of X Tuesdays and get caught up with stuff. It's just work for me has been really crazy. Happy to still have a job. But it's just been really crazy with what's going on in the world right now. And I'm working more hours than ever, 12, 14 hours like every day just to keep the trains running. So again, not complaining, happy to have a job. But it's made, like when I first heard, oh, you're going to be working from home, I thought, oh, great, I'm going to have more time to podcast. I'm going to be able to get caught up on things. But it's actually turned out to be the opposite. But that is our plan, to get to the Hawks and Pox stuff and the Dawn of X stuff, because I do want to get caught up. And if anything, going back and preparing for this episode and, you know, refreshing myself on things that happened in all the way back from House of M to Avengers versus X-Men and Death of X and Phoenix Resurrection, that's reawakened my love of the X-Men and reminded me how much I love these characters and love this world. Even if the storyline and such does get really convoluted at times. Look forward to seeing those episodes out on a little more regular basis for you all. So I want to thank Jean-Paul for listening, or for joining me, rather. And you have anything else you want to add, Jean-Paul, about this issue or X-Men in general?
Well, I was going to say, if you want to review the Phoenix Resurrection line, you have an episode on that. You can tell the listeners that you can go back in your catalog and listen to the Phoenix Resurrection review.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. I did review that one. It's a really great series, and I do recommend that. And hopefully this one will come out this coming Tuesday, and then we're going to follow it up with the X-Men, Age of X-Men Alpha, which is the first issue that kind of introduces that universe. So look for that on next week's X Tuesday. So thanks for listening, everybody. We'll talk to you next time.
You can find the Comic Source Podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whichever podcasting app you prefer. Please tell all your friends about us, subscribe, and rate us. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, be sure to visit us at lrmonline.com to join the conversation, access the show notes, and discover all our other great pop culture content. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter, twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.